I like helping people. I'm in here because I've done something, some things I know I shouldn't have done, and I think this is like my way of giving back.
From the Public Radio Reporting Collaborative, Side Effects Public Media, this is The Workaround.
Stories of the difficult and sometimes shocking things people do to get around America's healthcare system and get the help they need.
I'm Esther Honig.
And I'm Jake Harper.
So, Jake.
Yes?
Before I tell you exactly what the workaround I found is, I think it's really important to understand where it takes place.
Hey, I'm sorry. I was running a little late this morning.
Oh, that's all right. I got to do a pit stop on the way down, or way up.
To get to this place, you have to pass through these heavy locking doors. And not just anyone can come in either. You have to have a pass, and you have to sign in. And inside, the floors are lined with linoleum, and the ceilings, they all have fluorescent lights. And there's nurses in scrubs, right? And they're running around with clipboards, and they're checking in patients.
Ms. Thomas from PT, call control.
So are we in a hospital?
Not quite. There's a main room in this place, and it has a TV, and it's blaring some just god-awful daytime television.
Is it like Jerry Springer or Maury?
Exactly.
Sounds like Jerry Springer in there.
In this place, there's quilts hanging on the walls to make it really feel kind of comfy and homey. And a group of elderly men, they're all sitting around a table, putting together a puzzle. Some folks are in wheelchairs.
Okay, I think I've got it. Are we in a nursing home?
No.
All right, so what is it? Where are we?
This is a prison.
So it sounds much more like a nursing home than what I imagine a prison is like.
Right. See, our prison population has been rapidly aging for years. And when prisoners get too old or too ill or both, they get transferred to places like this. And if you're an elderly prisoner in Ohio, you might come here specifically to the Franklin Medical Center in Columbus. It looks very much like a nursing home, but with fewer windows and a metal detector. And the orderlies, well, they're actually prisoners themselves, and they're called porters. And one of these porters is really well known amongst the staff and patients at Franklin Medical Center, and his name is Daryl Williams.
Every time I greet a person that I just met, you know, I tell them what my name is, because they'll, hey, porter. Hey, runner, hey, my name is Chop. You call me Chop. You know, you need anything, just call me and I'll come and get it for you. If you need my help with something, just call me.
So what's with this nickname? What does Chop mean?
So it's short for pork chop. So Daryl used to be a bigger guy until 4 or 5 years ago when he started exercising and dieting and he lost a ton of weight. And with it went the pork part of the name, and now everyone just calls him Chop.
If the nurses need assistance with somebody, they'll call me and I'll, you know, help them out.
So Daryl has worked on this floor for about 2 years, but he lives on the other side of the prison in a separate building that looks totally different. There are cells, not rooms. There are no hospital beds. There are guards instead of nurses. But every day, Daryl gets to come to this side of the prison to work as a porter, helping these elderly inmates. And this is how we arrive, dun-da-da, at the workaround.
And the workaround is?
It's Daryl. He's the workaround. We all know that this country has the highest rate of incarceration in the world. There are around 2.2 million people behind bars in the U.S., and they're getting old fast. Experts estimate that by 2030, one-third of prisoners will be considered elderly. And these elderly prisoners, they need a ton of additional care and supervision. A study by the Pew Research Center found that the U.S. spends $16 billion a year caring for aging inmates. So that's where our workaround, Daryl, comes in. What prisons are doing now, instead of hiring additional staff to care for the elderly, they're creating programs where younger inmates like Daryl are being trained to help take care of older inmates.
How much does Daryl get paid to do this?
It's about $50 a month.
Really? Why? This is full-time work, right?
Yeah.
So prisons use the cheaper labor of inmates to work around the higher cost of hiring, you know, trained employees to take care of these elderly prisoners?
Exactly.
Paying Daryl so little, who benefits from those savings? Where does that money go?
Well, in theory, we are the taxpayer. Prisons run on tax dollars, and if they don't have to increase their budget to hire more people to take care of those elderly prisoners, then ideally that money can go towards other things like schools and local infrastructure.
So what kind of work does Daryl actually do as a porter?
He does a little of everything, but I'll let him explain.
This is like working in a nursing home. So you got to care for them. You got to bathe them. You got to feed them. You got to change their beds. You got to make their beds, you know, and because some of them can't do that.
But I think the most important thing is that he really builds a relationship with these prisoners that other non-inmates maybe can't.
I can see a lot of me, really, in some of these people. And it's like a mirror effect. And when I walk past, they'll say, hey, there's my guy, or hey, Chop, come here. You know, they remember me.
And that kind of relationship, it's not only important for the patient, but for Daryl, too. This work really gives him a sense of purpose and pride, and it's hard work. Many of these inmates have serious health conditions like terminal cancer or advanced diabetes, but probably the most difficult patients are the ones who have Alzheimer's or other types of cognitive diseases like dementia. Research has actually shown that people in prison may be more prone to these diseases than people in the free population.
And I know they don't remember a lot of things that they've done because half the time they don't even know why they're in prison.
So they don't remember what crime they committed to get there?
Well, that's what Daryl says. But they do remember that they've done something wrong. Most of the time they might ask Daryl why they're there, but he doesn't like to remind them. He says it gets them really upset.
They probably don't even know how long they've been locked up. Some of them are like, I don't know, I think I've been locked up 2 or 3 years, but when you look at their number, you know, they've been down more than 10 years.
Daryl told me about two patients that he's gotten really close to. Both have some form of cognitive disease. And we can't use their names because we don't have legal permission to share their identity or discuss their healthcare information. But one of these prisoners, Daryl says he doesn't even know where he is. In fact, he thinks he's home.
At one point, he said it. He owned this place. It was his house, and they built all these other rooms around him, and he don't know why they did that, so, you know, but I don't know what he's doing all these rooms in here, but, you know, I didn't ask him to put these rooms in here, you know, just things like that, so.
He'll tell Daryl about all the fishing trips he used to take with his kids, years before he was in prison.
Probably because those were the days when they were most bonded with their family members. Yeah. That day is something that they couldn't hold on to. A memory that I can hold on to.
And he'll talk about how his wife is coming to pick him up any day now, which, you know, Daryl says will never happen because his wife has already passed away. But other inmates can get stuck in even darker places. Like this one patient, Daryl actually walked into the room and he caught him talking to people who aren't there.
Like one day I walked in the room and he was like, wait a minute, you see him having a conversation?
Does Daryl know who he's talking to?
So Daryl believes that this man is talking to his victims, and he's actually almost reliving the crime that he committed and trying to defend himself against everyone and trying to sort of, you know, validate his actions.
There's some things he says when he's talking to himself that tells me what he'd done, but I don't hear the remorse in his conversation about this situation. I don't know. I think he's fighting the demons in his own self. So, but he knows he's dying.
Obviously, Daryl's making a choice to do this work. Did he ever tell you why he wanted to work with these patients?
Yeah, and his answer really shocked me. Daryl's mom has Alzheimer's. Daryl's been in and out of prison for the last 25 years. He's due to be released in 2020, about a year and a half from now. And his mom was diagnosed with Alzheimer's about 4 years ago. So every day he goes to work, he's thinking about his own mother.
I know that when I go home, I'm going to have to take care of my mom. So this is just like a practice trial run for me, because I see people at some bad times.
Daryl's mom has actually never visited him. He says it's too much for her and her condition. I don't think he really likes her seeing him in prison, and I don't think she really likes seeing her son in prison. So instead, he just talks to her on the phone every week. Daryl says he remembers the first time he heard her forget something.
She forgot, you know, it was my birthday, so. But, you know, she apologized and she sent my birthday card. And,
yeah.
I try to call her as much as I can. Sometimes she just, I don't know, she just forgets.
I can't imagine what it must be like for Daryl. You know, this is his only point of contact with his mom, and he's starting to lose that. But I have some idea of what that experience is like because I've been through it too. My dad was diagnosed with Alzheimer's when I was 20. And, you know, I clearly remember the first time I witnessed my dad forget something that I just thought was unimaginable, you know, something I never thought he would forget about as a father.
What was it?
He forgot about me. I was sitting next to him on the couch, and it had been a few years since he was diagnosed, and I was kind of quizzing him, asking him to tell me the story about my oldest sister and how she was born. He told me, and then I asked him, okay, tell me about my middle sister and how was she born? And then I said, tell me about the next daughter, which is me. And he just looked at me very matter-of-factly, and Mia said, those are my only daughters.
I mean, I imagine that was really hard for you. Is your dad's diagnosis why you chose to do this story?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I wanted to understand what it was like for people in prison to forget themselves and maybe, you know, even forget the crime that they committed. And I wanted to know what the care for them was like because of my experience. Caring for someone with Alzheimer's is incredibly costly. It's, you know, eaten up my parents' savings. Just being able to put my dad in a nursing home that accepts Medicaid. And, you know, watching your parent forget you, it's really painful. But unlike Daryl, you know, I actually got to be there in person and witness it. And I can't imagine how much more, you know, I can't imagine how much more difficult it must have been to witness this whole process and witness his mother just sort of fade away over the phone. And there's nothing he can do about it. He's just, you know, locked up behind bars. And, you know, he's told me he feels like he's racing against the clock. Every day is another day lost for him that he could have been spending with his mom before she forgets everything.
I know it's going to be hard. I'm praying that she's there still. She keeps saying every time I call her, I'm not going to be here when you come home. I'm not going to be here when you come home. And I said, yes, you are. You are.
So he wants to get out of prison in time to show his mom the person he's become. He has his GED. He's taking care of himself now. He says, you know, when I get out, he, you know, just wants to buy a house and start a family. But the most important thing for him is that by the time he gets out, his mom is still there mentally, that she's still his mom. And he doesn't want to miss out on that.
I just want to know, let her know I love her. If she's there, I would love to make the memories. Something that I can remember her by, because I know I ain't got that much time left.
And she can see, you know,
the change in me.
You know, this isn't really a question, but something I've been thinking about this whole time. These people that have Alzheimer's, they don't remember what they've done. Like, to a certain extent, it's like they're not even the same people they were when they committed their whatever crime got them there.
Right, exactly.
I mean, it just seems bizarre to keep punishing them, especially if it's going to cost so much money to keep them in prison.
I mean, it's fairly obvious, right? I mean, people grow old and a lot of them get diseases like Alzheimer's and dementia. But the fact that they would still be incarcerated boggled my mind. Just they're no longer the people that made that horrific mistake. I mean, when Alzheimer's really takes over, you know, whether that individual was a serial killer or a drug dealer, a rapist, just by having seen my dad go through this process, I know that those prisoners, they can't be that person anymore who made those horrific mistakes. I mean, they can't figure out how to feed themselves or even get dressed alone. There's no way they could intentionally harm someone. Their mind is destroyed. I mean, eventually, these people just become like a blank slate.
One of the things that strikes me about this is, you know, I think to a certain extent, elderly people are kind of pushed aside in our society. But keeping them in prison like this, they're even further out of sight.
Right. Like we put people behind bars to forget about them. And now when a major issue like this arises, you know, hardly anyone is talking about it. But in order to move forward and solve this, you know, I think it's important that we understand how we got here. So I reached out to an expert. I got in touch with Ron Adey. He's a sociologist and the author of Aging Prisoners, Crisis in American Corrections. He's been studying aging inmates since the 80s. And he explained that we really created this problem for ourselves in the 80s and early 90s with mandatory minimum sentencing. You know, that's taking away the discretion from the judge to determine how long a person's sentence should be. You know, this is how we wound up with people with nonviolent drug offenses being put away for years.
In 1983, for example, the average person serving a life sentence was getting out after about 9 years if they got paroled. And today that number is 29. You know, so people are staying considerably longer amount of time for that same sentences that they were receiving, you know, 20 or 30 years ago.
So Adey says another factor is that many states have taken this hard line against crime. States like Ohio have done away with parole boards. They now have what's called truth in sentencing. And that means someone sentenced to 25 years has no option to be released sooner for good behavior. And Adey says these are really drastic measures, but it's also incredibly popular with voters.
You know, no politicians ever run on a policy or platform of let's let them out. It's always let's lock them up.
So being tough on crime is generally widely supported. And what's really interesting to me about this, in the next 10 years, we as constituents are going to have to make a really important choice about which is more important to us. Is it being tough on crime or is it being fiscally conservative?
But people have to decide, you know, by their pocketbook. If we're going to keep those people in prison, it's going to cost $100,000. Who knows? Somebody can, these people can go to an emergency room or be in ICU for you know, 2 months, and it's going to cost, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars because just to prove what? Because these people are sick, they're in wheelchairs, but we're going to hold on to them because they committed this crime way back 30 or 40 years ago, and we're going to hold on to them.
So most states don't have a mechanism to release elderly prisoners who are fatally ill and unlikely to commit another crime. And for the ones that do, the process is just so lengthy and bureaucratic. It's called medical parole or sometimes sympathy release. And it basically allows an inmate to go home to die. But that requires the approval of the director of the state's prison system, as well as the approval of the governor in many cases. So they are just very, very rare.
It kind of seems crazy that this isn't more common. You know, when I think about someone who's 80 years old and can't really physically overpower anyone, or, you know, especially if they have Alzheimer's and they can't even think to do something like that, I would have thought that it's more common.
You would, yeah, you would think that, right? Like, this person is harmless. Let them go home. But it's not that simple. You know, I talked to the director of the Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections in Ohio. His name is Gary Moore. And he said in 2017, just 8 people received sympathy release. In Ohio, you actually have to appear before a judge and prove that this inmate, this person, is on death's door.
We have to ensure that the medical condition is accurate and that the folks are not going to pose a public safety issue. One mistake, Esther, can cause years of future concern and can really hurt those folks coming behind them in terms of that. So we have to ensure that we have authentic folks that have these medical conditions, and then we provide and work with the judges to help them with their decision on that.
So of those 8 inmates, 6 actually died before the judge could issue a decision. That means just 2 people were allowed to go home. And for Gary, dealing with this aging prison population is frustrating. He says he doesn't want to spend any more money building prisons, but they've recently built a dementia unit and an assisted living unit. And this coming year, they'll use another $30 million to build additional geriatric facilities in their prison system. Gary's worked in the Ohio prison system since the 70s, and he's watched the population explode. And he knows that this is, you know, due in part to the laws like truth in sentencing.
The limitation of being able to look at individuals and be able to release folks based on great behavior, et cetera, it's a management tool in our prisons that we lost.
But, you know, this sort of tough on crime approach, it's again, you know, it's extremely popular.
So we're basically warehousing these older inmates because it's politically supported?
Right. Yeah, it has a lot to do with politics.
But can we afford to do that?
It is costing us a ton. We talk a lot about the cost of our criminal justice system. So on average, to house an inmate in the general prison population, it costs us about $34,000 a year. An elderly inmate, though, someone with medical issues like Alzheimer's, that cost to the system is nearly $70,000. And that's according to a report by the American Civil Liberties Union. So I think the answer is no. Like, we really can't afford to be doing this.
What are we going to do?
Right now, the solutions that these prisons can take are either to build their own nursing home on their own, which is incredibly expensive, or like a lot of states, including, you know, the Federal Bureau of Prisons, they're using these porter programs to help them adapt their existing facilities. This workaround with the porters, it may not be perfect, but it Day says, you know, there is a silver lining because it seems to have a redeeming effect on the porters.
And the inmates themselves will tell you how it's really changed their life and their view of themselves when they came in as maybe hardened and angry. And so it's really made a great difference in terms of, you know, giving them a sense of purpose and the opportunity that they have to give back and make their life more meaningful.
Oh no, I'm just at peace when I'm over here. I feel like a free person when I'm over here. I don't get treated like I'm an inmate. I get treated like a person.
I mean, I don't know if this is rude to ask, but what did Daryl do to end up in prison?
I think it's a sensitive topic, but I'm going to let him explain it.
I've broken into homes, broken into businesses, and took things that I shouldn't have taken. But, you know, I did that to feed a drug habit. And that part of my life that I'm truly I'm ashamed of, because I didn't have to do that, you know. Do I feel remorse for what I've done? Yes. Am I sorry for what I've done? Of course. Can I change what I've done? No. I can only do better, you know, with myself.
So earlier we talked about the late 80s and 90s and how that was really the era of tough on crime. And that had everything to do with the crack cocaine epidemic. And Daryl struggled with a crack addiction. So reading through his record, you know, I saw that he broke into homes. Sometimes he stole electronics. Other times he got away with a handful of spare change. And on a few occasions, he was caught driving a stolen car. Some of the police reports, they mentioned that he had a crack pipe. Other times he admits to having smoked crack before getting arrested. And really, just what this makes me think about is how addiction can drive people to do unthinkable things. And while reporting for this story, I often found myself wishing that our politicians during the crack cocaine epidemic had understood that this was a health crisis. I mean, Daryl was struggling with addiction and he needed medical treatment, not decades in jail.
Yeah, I mean, so for my episode of this podcast, I focused on opioid addiction. And a lot of people I've talked to reporting on opioid addiction, they've committed crimes. They've stolen things. I think one of the things that's changed since the 80s and 90s is that people are starting to become more aware. Like, they understand a little bit more than they used to that addiction is a disease. Like, it's not this moral failing. It's an actual medical condition. You know, a lot of people still don't see it that way. So we have a long way to go. But there are more efforts now than there used to be to get people into medical treatment when they are suffering from addiction.
I think a lot of people are quick to point out that the crack cocaine epidemic was just treated very differently. You know, we were so much more focused on locking people up as opposed to getting them treatment. But the system today is still really complicated and people are falling through the cracks, just like Daryl.
So he's stuck in prison, but what is his healthcare situation there? Like, does he have mental health care? I mean, he's taking care of these people, but is anyone taking care of him?
So that really comes to another part of the story. I was able to meet with Daryl several times and interview him. And on our last interview, he actually told me that he was getting ready to leave this position. He said over the years, the people he's cared for have become his friends, and he's had to watch quite a few of them pass away.
I don't want to do this no more. Just send me back off the street. I'm tired of seeing people, you know, die.
You know, part of what I was wondering about all this is, where does this workaround break down? It sounds pretty emotionally taxing. If you're a worker in the free population, you can go home to your family and have these other support systems available to you, where Daryl basically just goes back to his cell at the end of the day.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's not a job for everyone. Being a porter requires a lot of compassion, and I think that can be something that's hard to come by in prison. Daryl told me, you know, not all prisoners are willing to do the less glamorous chores, like helping someone shower or, you know, changing a bedpan. And you know, others, they just can't be trusted to serve such a vulnerable population. In fact, you know, I had prison officials tell me that they don't always have as many porters as they would like because they don't have enough good candidates. So the porter program is by no means the end-all solution to the aging prison population.
So I have one last question. Do you think Daryl will get out in time, you know, for his mom? Will she remember him?
God, I don't know. Alzheimer's affects everyone so differently. You know, my own dad, he seemed perfectly normal for the first few years. And then he just unraveled so quickly. I hope so badly that by the time Daryl gets out, you know, there's still something of his mother there.
Fully communicated this to you, but my father has Alzheimer's. So I know that, you know, a lot of what you're going through. And for me, when, you know, I first started to realize he was forgetting things, there were certain events that I'd lived through that I was really sad that he would forget. Are there certain things that you think about, like certain events that you don't want her to forget?
Yeah. We like to... Yes, we used to go on fishing trips a lot, so, you know, she loves to fish, so, yeah. Just being with the family, being together. Our family reunions were nice. You know, everybody gets together and we go to the park and bring out, you know, all kind of food and stuff like that, and everybody gets together. So, yeah, barbecue ribs was the best.
Yes. Are there maybe certain events that you're okay that your mom will forget?
No.
No, the whole journey, you want to keep all of it. Yeah. Do you think that's important, you know, like having like the good with the bad, sort of like that makes...
Well, yeah, because, you know, everything is not always going to be good. So sometimes the good is great, and sometimes the bad things that happen, you know, enhance the good things sometimes. So...
The Workaround is brought to you by SideFX Public Media.
We're a regional health reporting group based at NPR member station WFYI in Indianapolis.
KBIA in Columbia, Missouri. St. Louis Public Radio. WILL in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois. WNIN in Evansville, Indiana. And WOSU in Columbus, Ohio. All contribute to SideFX.
Thanks to consultant Starley Kine for her early thinking on this project.
And finally, a special thanks to Carmel Roth. She's the former editor and founder of SideFX Public Media, who created the idea of the Workaround.
I'm Jake Harper.
And I'm Esther Honig. Thank you for listening.